Welcome to Words and Pictures, a show about the narrative arts. I'm your host, S.W. Counser, and I'm joined today by a comics writer and artist whose titles have included Unsupervised Existence, The Dreaming, and Cud Comics. He's collaborated with some of the top names in the alternative and mainstream comics industries, and he teamed up with his wife, Patty, to create the daily newspaper strip Edge City. His latest project is the graphic novel Mendel the Mess-Up. Terry Laban, welcome to Words and Pictures.
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
Well, I do want to talk about your alternative comics, but first, you have a graphic novel called Mendel the Mess-Up.
Yes.
And this is your graphic novel that's geared towards middle school readers.
Yes, it's a middle grade graphic novel. I've wanted to do a middle grade novel for a while now, maybe for about 10, 15 years. I mean, when I was doing my comic stuff, I couldn't imagine doing stuff for kids. I really had no impulse towards doing it. I have two kids, and all the time I was, you know, they were growing up, we read like tons of books. And then I realized that I did have a background in that kind of storytelling because I wrote Donald Duck comics. And that was like a regular gig with Egmont, which is a Disney licensee in Europe. So the kind of stories that they do, Donald Duck stories, are very middle grade. You know, they're very classic storytelling. There's a lot of action, character-based. They move really fast. So I realized, these are actually like the kind of stories that I want to tell right now. And I went through a number of ideas, but this one sold, Mendel the Mess-Up. So it's a story about a kid who can't do anything right, who ends up single-handedly defending his village from a band of Cossacks. And it's sort of a historical fiction thing set in sort of the Jewish shtetls of old Eastern Europe. It's kind of a fantasy world based on that. Sort of the default world in fantasy is this medieval world, this sort of Lord of the Rings. You know, we all recognize that. We don't, you know, as soon as we see that, we don't need to know if it's actually, you know, corresponds to like the 12th century or the 14th century or anything like that, right? We knights, dragons, there's a king. So I kind of wanted to take that idea and put it in, you know, the context of, you know, my ethnic background and the archetypes that are in my head. That's my starting point for doing that book. But I was able to kind of use a lot of my Donald Duck lessons, I think, and sort of create something that was really a page turner, that was really character based, and that, you know, I hope, you know, people can't put down. Those are the kind of things that I really liked to read when I was a kid. And the response has been, you know, pretty good. I was a finalist for a National Jewish Book Award. So that was really exciting.
Yeah. So the story, it's set in a fictional village, in a fictional land, maybe in the Baltics, but definitely late 19th century, kind of resembles the Tsarist Russia from the play Fiddler on the Roof.
Yes. And of course, Fiddler on the Roof is a big, so, you know, I always tell people, I don't, you know, my family came from that sort of place, and my family came from all over Eastern Europe. But I think, you know, for me and a lot of other sort of American Ashkenazi East European Jews, the idea of the shtetl, the idea of the old country looms large, right? We're very aware of the kind of place we came from, but our awareness of that, or at least mine, I should say, is based really on pop culture and the things I've read. So Fiddler on the Roof, it sort of substitutes for memory, I think, for a lot of people. And it becomes a kind of foundational myth in a kind of way, I'm going to say, or a foundational archetype for the way people from my background think about the place where their ancestors live. And I think that's a really interesting thing as a cartoonist. I've always been fascinated by archetypes, images or categories of things that stand for something larger and takes on a symbolic significance in the minds of people. And they're not necessarily things that necessarily correspond to reality, right? You know, we still draw rich people wearing a top hat, even though people haven't dressed that way in 100 years or maybe more. So I was sort of fascinated by the way this archetype of the shtetl, based on not on living memory or the memory of relatives, but these pop culture things. And, you know, I've read books about the shtetl, and I've seen, you know, other sorts of plays and movies. And, you know, of course, people like Maurice Sendak did often place his characters in a Eastern European setting. So I was really interested in the way all these things sort of work in my brain, and then approaching history in the sense of sort of putting myself in it, Right. So one of the experiences I've had is just looking at pictures that were taken at that time in the shuttle, people who lived there, and looking at the faces of the people and sort of trying to see the faces of my friends and relatives in them, because those are our faces, but they're dressed completely different and they're in this completely different setting. And that just really fascinated me, and I felt the kind of connection. So one of my motivations for doing the book was to kind of place myself in that history and make that kind of connection and take all those archetypes and sort of make them my own.
You mentioned Maurice Sendak, and a lot of his characters are scrappy young people. And there are so many stories of scrappy young people from the old country, if you'll pardon the expression. And Mendel, the hero of your book, is a 12-year-old boy who everybody thinks is cursed.
Right.
And this is a real familiar story about fortunes turning around.
Yeah, and it's also a story about self-image, right? So I've often had this feeling in my life, like that I'm cursed, especially in periods of my life when it just seemed like nothing was working out. Put stuff out there, or even like I'd get published and my comic would come out and it wouldn't sell, and I'd get to a certain place and it just like things wouldn't happen. And sometimes I haven't had the best self-image, and I've been like very self-deprecating. And I felt like I'm cursed. I felt like there's certain aspects of my personality that I wish I could change, and if I could only change them, things would go better for me. And this is essentially Mendel. This is essentially the way Mendel feels. He might really be cursed, he might really not be cursed, but thinking that you're cursed, that there's parts of yourself that you just can't live with, but you just can't change. That's not just a middle school feeling, although I think that's a time in life when those kind of feelings can be particularly intense, but that's a very human feeling. And for Mendel, self-acceptance is a big theme in kids' books, obviously, and has been right now. But it seems to me that the kind of self-acceptance that's often talked about is people wanting to fit in with a group, or wanting to fit in, be accepted by a larger, or accepting themselves even though they're not being accepted by some kind of larger group. But what interests me is self-acceptance, of accepting those parts of yourself that you don't like and you can't change. So it's really an internal self-acceptance.
Well, you mentioned how much you like archetypes, how you're drawn to archetypes. And there's a sage in the story. There's a young sage character who helps Mendel along his hero's journey.
Right, newly Seckelmacher. And yeah, he's kind of the, I guess he's kind of the Yoda, but he's a kid who's really good at his studies, where Mendel's really not. And he attempts to help Mendel get better at studying by showing him this trick where he envisions a hand writing out the thing that he's trying to memorize. And in Mendel's world, and actually in traditional Jewish culture, studying really meant memorizing sacred texts. Right, that's what they would do. They would actually just, it wasn't about debating, or that would come at a more advanced point. But when people were little, they would actually just sit and memorize sacred text. And so this is what Mendel's trying to do, but it's very difficult for him. So Newley gives him this trick, and Mendel tries it. It seems to work initially, and then it doesn't. And Mendel ends up messing up yet again and getting kicked out of school. But Newley tells him, don't give up. Sometimes the thing that you think is your worst quality, or the thing that you dislike most, is turns out to be your greatest asset. And Mendel is like, okay, that sounds nice, but I don't really know how that works. But then later in the story, it comes back and he sees how it can work, and it does work.
So the village is invaded by Cossacks and people flee, but Mendel runs afoul of this group of Cossacks. And there's a climactic moment in the book where Mendel says, I've had it with these Cossacks, their cruelty and ignorance, how they wreck things and hurt people for no reason except that they think it's fun. And I can't help but think that there might be an analogy there. Did you have any contemporary groups in mind when you wrote that?
Well, I wrote the book several years ago, and I wasn't thinking of any contemporary groups in particular. I mean, but what I was thinking about was this notion of Cossacks, right? As like, the archetypal enemy of, Eastern European Jews. And We talk about Cossacks. I mean, people will say things are great, until the Cossacks come. I mean, there's always this notion that somewhere out of, the wilderness or the darkness or the mountains can come this force that can completely disrupt and destroy your life. And also, I'm sort of fascinated by Cossacks because of the way they look. They're very colorful. And in fact, there was a whole genre of 19th century romantic painting where people would paint, romantic depictions of Cossacks. And in doing my research for the way they were going to look, I came across these things quite a bit. But then I also realized in creating the story that there are connections to middle school experience, right? I don't want middle schoolers to just read a historical novel. I want them to make an emotional connection to the story. So I realize that in a certain kind of way, like the Cossacks are kind of bully, right? Not just any bully, they're like kind of the cool, like jockey kids that can get away with anything, Like it's not that they're, I mean, they are intentionally mean a lot of times, but it's more just that they don't care and they just feel so entitled. And they'll come to your house when, you're having some friends over, and when your parents are away, and they'll show up at your house and they'll just trash the place, and nothing will ever happen to them because their parents are rich, or they're so handsome, or they're stars of the football team, or something like that. So it was a certain kind of bully that isn't always even a bully. It's just people you can't, that are heedless and careless and, unthinkingly cruel. Mendel's like a good person and his instincts are good. That's not true of everybody in the book. And what I thought was really interesting about that particular moment was that Mendel, he goes back into the village to, he's helping his family at this point try to lure the Cossacks out so they can scare them away. And Mendel has this whole plan because he's actually terrified of the Cossacks. So he's got this whole plan of how it's going to work, and he's going to lure them out and lure them towards family who's hiding, and they're going to mimic an ambush and try to scare the Cossacks off. But he's got this whole plan for how it's going to work because he's terrified of the Cossacks. But when he sees the Cossacks committing this huge injustice on the guy that's actually been the most evil person in the book, Pivik, the guy who's actually like the main motivator among the Cossacks for harming Mendel and harming his family, he sees Pivik being mistreated by his fellow Cossacks. And he's just so outraged by it, he basically loses his plan and just sort of confronts the Cossacks. And that ends up blowing his plan. But, in the end, it ends up working out. But I just thought that was really interesting because this notion of having a core of decency that's so deep that even the person that you have reason to hate most in the world, you can't see that person being unjustly abused. I thought that that was just a really interesting dynamic, and it really spoke to Mendel's character.
You're listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser. And we're talking today with comics creator Terry Laban. His titles have included Unsupervised Existence, Cud Comics, The Dreaming, and the daily strip Edge City. His latest project is the graphic novel Mendel the Mess Up. Yeah, you've had a long career in the comics industry. You were a leading talent in the alternative comics scene of the 1990s. And then you and your spouse created a daily newspaper strip that ran for many years. And that strip is called Edge City. It's centered around a community-minded Jewish family, I'm assuming much like your own.
Yeah, I mean, it was about a Jewish family raising kids. It was sort of about the contemporary, parenting lifestyle that we were experiencing through the aughts. The strip started in 2001. They didn't start out Jewish, actually, but, well, we always thought of them as Jewish, but we kind of came out in our second year. And, I mean, we didn't do Jewish stuff in the strip all the time or even that much. There was like a few times, we would do a holiday. We always do like a Passover story, that was kind of like our great pumpkin. We'd always do like a Sunday strip about the high holidays. But, we would go for long stretches. It would just be sort of a strip about contemporary family life. And, doing a comic strip, doing a syndicated comic strip was basically my childhood fantasy. I mean, I'm old enough to remember when newspaper comic strips were, not just a big deal, but like the biggest deal. And when I was a young cartoonist, especially when I was doing my alternative comics, everybody I met who was unfamiliar with alternative comics, which was pretty much everybody would say, are you syndicated? Like that was the first question anybody would ever ask. So if you aspired to be a cartoonist when I was a kid, you aspired to be a syndicated cartoonist, or you aspired to have an animated show on Saturday mornings. I mean, those were the two really big deals. And I like comic books, but that wasn't what I aspired to back then. So as I got older, I discovered underground comics, and that's what got me into wanting to do comic books. But I never gave up wanting to do a strip, and I submitted some over the years. It's not something I did like all the time, but I would go through phases like, I'm trying to do a comic strip. But towards the end of the 90s, my comics career was kind of grinding to a halt. I had two kids, alternative comics. They never paid very much, and I couldn't really justify doing that kind of work anymore. And anyways, I'd kind of gotten to the end of what I wanted to do with it. And then I got into writing for DC through doing The Dreaming, which was a spin-off of Sandman. And I did the first story arc for that. It was like an anthology series where they'd have different writers and artists doing stories based on the Sandman world, and they were hoping it would kind of fill in some of the space left when Neil Gaiman actually stopped doing Sandman. He quit right around that time. I'm not a mainstream comics guy, and that's sort of what happened. I was like a folk singer at a death metal concert. Not, I don't have the mainstream comic sensibility, and mainstream comics is all about the fans. It's all about doing stuff for the fans. And if you're not in tune with that world, it's really hard to sustain it. And it was my wife that really came up with the notion of we had two little kids at the time. I think our kids were like 6 and 3.
And your wife, Patty, is a couples and family therapist. That's
Yes,
an
she is.
interesting talent to bring to the table.
Yeah, and it was really good because, first of all, I could never have done a strip like that all on my own year after year because I don't get out enough and I don't know enough about the world and contemporary issues. And Patty was seeing like all these people, and she really had actual jobs. And so she brought this whole wealth of knowledge and insight. And also, I'd worked with Patty before, uncredited, a lot of my Unsupervised Existence stuff. Unsupervised Existence was a book that
Yeah,
Patty.
let's talk about this, because this was your first unsupervised existence, was really your first big comic series. It earned you two Harvey Award nominations, and this is the comic where you introduce a cast of characters who are all creative in their own ways, but all kind of adrift.
Yeah. It was about a group of young bohemians in the city. And at first, it was sort of what I aspired to be because I started drawing it, doing it in Ann Arbor. And then it actually turned into my real life after we moved to Chicago. But I mean, I was very inspired by Love and Rockets.
The Hernandez Brothers
Yeah.
series.
That which was huge at the time. It was like the biggest indie book at that time. And I really wanted to do these kind of at the time, they called it slice of life, which is a term that I really hate. But I want to do real, quote unquote, realistic stories with a cast of characters drawn from my life, which I found was actually like a really hard thing to do. So I would write the stories and I would show them to Patty, and Patty would sort of give me feedback on them. And her feedback was great. But it was her input that really was crucial in shaping the series. I mean, I did the writing myself, but Patty really helped me to craft those stories. And at a certain point, I felt kind of trapped doing that kind of stuff. I felt like I wanted to kind of break out and do more kind of undergroundy stuff, funny stuff, like the stuff that really inspired me. And also, at a certain point, I didn't know what to do with the characters. Like, to really make the story work and to really make it work as a soap opera, like, things had to change in their lives. And I didn't know how to do it. And I just really hit a creative dead end with the whole thing. And in subsequent years, I felt a little bad. I felt like maybe I should have tried harder and that unsupervised existence was actually like a really good thing. And maybe I was just too ready to dump it. But that's where I was in that space. And then when I did Cud, like I didn't show it to
Well,
Patty.
this is Cud came out of, well, the breakout character from Unsupervised Existence was Bob Binkum, musician turned performance artist. He's sort of
Right.
the the chaotic character, and he runs off to Europe with nothing but a backpack and gets into crazy misadventures.
Right.
You know, and of course, this is all set back in the late 20th century before the internet or international credit. So it was an easy time to get lost somewhere, to not know quite where you are or what's going on.
Yes, well, I mean, that was based on my life. So, and I think it's in the introduction of the book. But after I graduated from college, I traveled around the world for a year and a half, just that way. And actually, if you follow me on Facebook or Instagram, but Facebook's better because I write more, this year's the 40th anniversary of that trip. And I've been posting sketchbook pictures because I filled four sketchbooks. I didn't carry a camera. I filled four sketchbooks with just sketches of the trip, which was also a diary journal. So I've been posting them in more or less real time as the corresponding more or less to the dates where I was at that time 40 years ago. So yeah, and I was completely out of touch with my family for like 6 months, a year. I mean, they didn't know where I was. Like nobody knew where I was. I mean, it's really scary when you think about it now. I would like die if my kids did that. So, you know, I kind of did that with Bob. And then I have this penchant. I don't know why. Like, I really like to recycle characters. I don't know why. I think it's, I'm not sure it's great. It confuses people on a certain level. But for some reason, I thought, yeah, I'm just going to use Bob in this new book. And I was inspired by 8-Ball. I really like the format of having, like, you know, you'd have like a 10-page continuing story. And then you'd have, you know, just these one-off things for the rest of the comic. So that's what I decided to do. And the Bob story, I decided to just use sort of, this is my archetype again. Like I decided to just use the sort of archetypal fame story as the structure and sort of play with that. And it was really a very idful comic.
Well, Bob Binkham sort of became Bob Cudd, inspired
Yeah.
Bob Cudd,
Right.
who became this performance artist. And the humor in the Cudd comics, it's no holds barred. There are awkward situations, there's nudity, bodily fluids, mayhem.
Yeah, I was trying to be Crumb. I mean, this is my Crumb fantasy, and I'll be honest, you know, I like this is where Robert Crumb led me. And you know, one thing you can say about that work, all my alternative comics, is I had absolute creative freedom and people to publish me. And I did it. I did what I did. I mean, some of it I had mixed feelings about. A lot of it was, I think, is still really good. You know, not like embarrassed by that work, but I did feel at a certain point also like, A, I'd run through all my one-off ideas. I'd really sort of explored what I had. B, that like I'm not Robert Crumb, not by a long shot. And C, I kind of got it out of my system. You know, I didn't want to be one of those guys that like spends his whole life being an underground cartoonist. At a certain point, and maybe it was kids, it was probably kids, I really lost the impulse to be this transgressive. I mean, I was really attracted to transgressive stuff. You know, I love punk rock. I love, you know, rock and roll. I love underground culture, that whole thing, you know, and I still do. I mean, I still really like that stuff. But that impulse to be transgressive myself and to make that the center of my work, it kind of left me.
So you mellow and you do a newspaper comic strip, and is it what having a family does to you? Is it
Well,
mellows
there's
you
also,
and
you know, I needed to make a living. I mean, I just, the strip was steady money, and you know, I didn't always love doing it because it's a grind, you know. And but you know, people change. I mean, I think change is a good thing. Like, I don't want to be doing the same stuff no matter what it was. Like, I don't think it's a great thing to be doing the same stuff that you did when you were 20, when you're 50. I get bored, and I mean, I want to change. So I didn't think of it so much as mellow. You know, Cud was a reflection of who I was when I did Cud. Edge City was a reflection of who I was when I did Edge City. And I guess Mendel the Mess Up is a reflection of, you know, who I am now and what I want to do.
So, okay, there's transgressive art and then there's transgressive art. And it's like if you're doing something like Alfred Jarry, Ubu Roy, and it's funny and it's sharp and it's political, that's great. If you're doing a comic and all it is a bunch of, you know, people getting their limbs chopped off, I mean, forget that. But you brought the humor in. One comics critic said about you, he knows how to draw funny, as Chuck Jones would say. More impressively, he can actually be funny about sex, which is harder than it sounds.
I think I remember that quote. Okay, I'll take it. I mean, I'm a funny person. That's always been the case. And it just comes out that way. I don't try to be funny necessarily. Sometimes I try not to be funny, but it just comes out that way.
Well, like the fellow said, you draw funny. You have one of the most distinctive styles in American comics. People can recognize your heavy brushwork, your big chunky inks.
Yeah, I do have a line. Chris Ware told me that. He said, "You're one of the few cartoonists out there that really has a line."
And a lot of your characters from Cud Comics are still much beloved. Two of your most popular characters were Eno and Plum. Yeah, they made their debut in Cud Comics, along with characters like Seymour Riverpeace, Plum's affluent aging hippie dad who owns a successful candle-making operation.
Eno and Plum was really a response to the whole Generation X thing and the whole grunge thing that was happening. So I was kind of like satirizing that. And then it kind of turned into my own sort of Archie thing because I
Yeah,
read.
you were there's some clear influence from Archie Comics in
For
Eno and
sure.
Plum, but you're also heavily inspired by the underground cartoonist Gilbert Shelton, who created the
I heard.
Fabulous Furry Freak Brothers.
There was a bunch of quotes. Fat Freddy's cat turned into Eno and Plum's cat. That was an obvious homage. Kathy, Plum's friend Kathy was Kathy, Kathy from the comic strip. She has like a little heart and she's always like freaking out. And Plum's skeevy boyfriend, I forget his name, was Reggie. Like, I did it deliberately. It was really deliberate. And those are fun stories to do. I had a good time doing that stuff.
There are a lot of satirical mashups in your comics. Mickey Pimple, Teen Adventurer is a bit of a twisted version of Tintin meets Terry and the Pirates.
Well, like I said, I'm fascinated by archetypes. I always have been, and in a way, like Mendel incorporates a lot of those sensibilities. I did a version of Archie set in, New Guinea. I did,
Right, right.
Muckchuck Wolf's Breath, Hardboiled Shaman was
That
like my.
was, yeah, Muktuk Wolf's Breath. Hard-boiled shaman, which you expanded into a DC comic series with artist Steve Parkhouse. It's sort of like if Raymond Chandler took up Scandinavian ethnography.
Right, and that actually had like a lot of legs. Jack Black bought an option to that at one point.
Oh, that was going to become like a film or something?
He bought an option that lasted for 6 months or so, or maybe it was three. I don't remember how long, but the guy that brought me in ended up leaving, and so that project went nowhere. But I got $3,000. So, and now you can't do it because people are, it's ethnic, so. You can't do something about contemporary people that are actually around where you actually don't know anything about them. And but yeah, all that stuff was, it was all exploring archetypes. That's what it all was. And it was fun. I did get to the point, and I think one thing I'm really happy with Mendel is that it's not just exploring archetypes. It's not just mashing up archetypes. It's making a real story with real characters in an archetypal world. And that's real writing. I think to some degree, satire is a little parasitical, right? It just takes things that already exist and makes fun of them. And that's great. I love satire. I've done a lot. But real writing is, I think, a different thing. And that's something I think I was able to do with Mendel. Not the only thing, but with Mendel, I did do it and I'm happy.
Well, you've been listening to Words and Pictures. I'm your host, S.W. Konser, and we've been talking today with comics creator Terry Laban. His titles have included Unsupervised Existence, Cud Comics, The Dreaming, and the daily strip Edge City. His latest project is the graphic novel Mendel the Mess Up. Terry, thanks so much for joining us.
Thank you so much. I wish I could stay out longer. I'm glad we got this in.
And for those listeners who might be interested in finding out more about your work, where would they look?
One place they should go is terryleban.com. That's got all my mental stuff and links to all my other work as well.
Well, thanks to all our listeners on the radio dial and on the web. You can find an archived version of this show later today at kboo.fm/wordsandpictures. And be sure to follow us on social media at Words and Picture.